Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. It's time to get back in the classroom and learn something new about American English. Our teacher is Jill Robbins, and she has a question for you.
Have you ever been in a conversation and wanted to check your understanding? That is the time to use a tag question in English. A tag question is a short question added to a statement. The tag includes a pronoun and its matching form of the verb be, or auxiliary verb. If the tag question is negative, we shorten the phrase or use a contraction with the auxiliary verb. Here's an example. I was visiting a friend and saw a photo on the wall. I said, "That's a picture of your grandson, isn't it?" My friend answered,
"Yes, it is. That picture is from when he was 2. He's a lot taller now."
In the example, I wanted to confirm something I thought was true. So, I started with a positive statement. "That's a picture of your grandson." Then, I added a negative tag question, "Isn't it?" My friend said I was right. The picture was of his grandson. English speakers use tag questions to encourage a listener to respond. You will often hear teachers using tag questions.
You remember the history lesson from last week, don't you?
Some language researchers say that men use tag questions more often than women. They think it might show that men have more power in the conversation and use tags to ask for information or agreement. Others say women use a certain kind of tag questions to make the conversation run more smoothly. Whatever your gender, when you use a tag question, you expect an answer. The form of that answer depends on the type of tag question. Let's look at the 2 types of tag questions.
We'll talk first about tag questions that follow a positive statement with the verb be. They use a reduced form or contraction. Make the tag question with the form of the verb be combined with the negative not and the pronoun. The verb be has to match the number and person of the pronoun. Take a look at these examples.
They are walking to school, aren't they? She is taking the bus, isn't she? I am supposed to be sitting here, aren't I? You're the math teacher, aren't you?
In these examples, you reverse the order of the pronoun and verb in the tag question. They are becomes aren't they? And she is becomes isn't she? If the statement uses another verb instead of be, the tag question uses an auxiliary verb, such as do or have. For example, in the song A Little Time, the singing duo Beautiful South ask the question,
"Need a little room for your big head, don't you, don't you?"
And,
"Your face has been looking like that for hours, hasn't it, hasn't it?"
If you ask a negative tag question, you expect a positive answer.
Question: "It's raining out, isn't it?" Expected answer: "Yes, it is."
Now let's look at tag questions that follow a negative statement. These are in the affirmative. You can use this to confirm that what you are thinking is true, and you expect a negative answer.
Question: You don't eat all the cake, do you? Expected answer: No, I don't.
Negative sentences with positive tag questions are not as frequent as our first type. They use the same form with reversed word order. Tag questions are an example of a big difference between British and American English. Language researchers using computer data found that British English speakers use tag questions 9 times as often as American English speakers. In Understanding and Using English Grammar, Betty Azar says that the intonation, or change in pitch, shows the purpose of a tag question. If the speaker is trying to confirm information, the tone rises.
Adam works at VOA, doesn't he?
I'm Jill Robbins.
Should we fear an invasion from outer space? Researchers have been searching and listening for life on other planets. They say we should not be concerned about alien beings anytime soon. Michael Garrett teaches at the University of Leiden. He is also the general and scientific director of the Netherlands Institute for Radio Astronomy. Professor Garrett has been listening for radio signals from other planets, searching for signs of extraterrestrial life. He says advanced civilizations are either rare or do not exist in the areas of outer space he has examined. He adds that natural processes are most likely responsible for any radio signals that have been received on Earth. He says that means we can all sleep safely in our beds tonight. An alien invasion doesn't seem at all likely. German researchers say they have discovered that some birds, like humans, can be choosy when deciding on a possible mate. The researchers work at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology. They performed experiments with zebra finch. They let groups of 20 female zebra finches freely choose their mate from among 20 males. Half of the resulting pairs were permitted to produce baby birds. The researchers split up the other couples and gave them a mate that the birds had not chosen themselves. The study found that the finch couples that chose one another produced many more babies than those that were forced together. There are many good reasons not to smoke tobacco. Researchers have added another. Smokers have a higher risk of losing their teeth than non-smokers. A new study shows that men who smoke are up to 3.6 times more likely to lose their teeth than men who do not smoke. Women are 2.5 times more likely to lose their teeth than women who don't smoke. The Journal of Dental Research published the findings. Thomas Dietrich was the main writer of the report. He is a professor at the University of Birmingham in England. He says most people lose their teeth from either tooth decay or gum disease, both of which can be caused by smoking. Because smoking can also hide gum disease, smokers may not know about the poor health of their mouths until it is too late and they start losing teeth. The study found that it is not only older people who lose their teeth. Researchers discovered that the connection between smoking and tooth loss was stronger among younger people than those who were older. I'm Jim Tedder. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Consumers around the world benefit from large food stores and large-scale food production. They can buy many fruits and vegetables throughout the year that were once sold only a few months out of the year. But there is a price to pay for this year-round availability. The fruits and vegetables, like tomatoes and strawberries, often don't taste as good as they once did. Researchers throughout the United States are working to change that.
So all the onions and potatoes are out at room temperature, and then this is warm.
Andrew Mace is a professional cook at a restaurant in Portland, Oregon.
Parsnips, leeks, yeah. Turnips, first of the year asparagus.
Mr. Mace says he hopes the researchers can create fruits and vegetables that are easy to ship and store, but also taste good.
Something that's not compromised for storability or shape or disease resistance. It's all about the flavor, and it's a more pure flavor.
Across the United States, breeders, farmers, seed producers, and professional cooks are working together to create vegetables that have more flavor and more vitamins, too. Jim Myers is a plant breeder at Oregon State University. He says he does traditional breeding. He says there is enough genetic variation to work with. He tries to create fruits and vegetables that taste good, but also have resistance to disease, can be stored for a long time, and can be shipped without being damaged. Mr. Myers says the lab has created a program to connect breeders with chefs. He says developers are going back to their traditional roots as breeders to improve vegetables. Phil Simon is a vegetable breeder at the U.S. Agricultural Research Service. He has been working to create a better carrot for 35 years. He says the local food movement in North America and other places is responsible for the increased interest in the flavor of food. He says the more extensive local production of vegetables has caused buyers to seek better quality. He says local growers are seeking to provide more kinds of vegetables to meet the demand of buyers. Many countries restrict imports of seeds and plants. So some of the new fruit and vegetables with increased flavor and nutrition are only available in the places in which they have been developed. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program about American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Andrew Jackson was nearing the end of his presidency. He had served two terms. For many Americans, Jackson remained incredibly popular. They liked that a poor boy from the frontier who could barely read and write grew up to become president. Historian Daniel Feller is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He calls the president and war hero the ultimate American self-made man.
He's a quintessentially American figure. You can't imagine anybody like this getting to be the head of a country at that time, certainly anywhere else but in the United States. And even in the United States, it would have been unheard of just a few years before.
Daniel Feller says Jackson often used government to help ordinary people instead of the rich and powerful. For this reason, many called him the people's president. But not everyone agreed. His opponents said, "Tyrants have always spoken in the name of the people." They said Jackson used his popularity to do whatever he wanted, whether it was legal or not. His opponents in Congress even denounced him with a censure resolution for not releasing some of his papers to the government. They called him King Andrew. Many American Indians called Jackson yet another name. They called him Jackson the Devil. Jackson wanted Native Americans in southern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, to move west. Jackson did not think it was right for Indian tribes to exist as independent nations within the United States. And white voters wanted Indians' land for farming. Historian Daniel Feller points out that the United States government had tried to get Indians to move away from white settlements for a long time, long before Jackson became president.
But Jackson brought an urgency to it that none of his predecessors had. Quincy Adams and Monroe had endeavored to remove Indians when Indians seemed to be willing to be removed. Jackson took the position that they need to be removed now.
In 1830, Jackson pushed a bill through Congress called the Indian Removal Act. The bill allowed him to create new Indian homelands in the Oklahoma Territory, an area west of the Mississippi River where few white Americans lived at the time. The federal government would essentially trade the Indians their old land for the new land and pay for tribes to move west permanently.
He managed to convince himself, and I think that's the best way to put it, that he was actually doing the Indians a favor, that Indian tribes that remained in proximity to whites simply disintegrated. Their tribal structure, their national structure disintegrated. They died.
Daniel Feller says just because Jackson believed he was helping the Indians did not mean he did not benefit from their removal or that he was right. Besides, the Indians did not have much choice. Jackson told them that if they did not accept his offer, their nations would be controlled by the American government. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creeks agreed under pressure. The Cherokees resisted. They even took their case to the Supreme Court, which agreed that the Indians were independent from state authority. But Jackson and the state of Georgia ignored the Supreme Court's decision. Eventually, soldiers forced the Cherokees from their homes and marched them over 1,600 kilometers to Oklahoma. More than 5,000 died. The forced march later became known as the Trail of Tears. Even the Indians who survived continued to suffer. The United States government did not meet the terms of the treaty. Few Indians were paid for their goods. Most were not given food and other supplies during the journey,
or when they arrived in Oklahoma. Daniel Feller notes that the United States has a long history of defaulting on its treaties with Indian nations, both before and after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson might not have intended for the Indians to suffer so much, but he did not lead his government to respect and protect them either.
There are many who regard Jackson as being the kind of epitome, the exemplar, the personification of everything that has been wrong, not only regrettable, but perhaps evil, in white America's treatment of the Indians.
Daniel Feller says Jackson's treatment of the Native Americans, along with some of his other actions, complicates his image as an American hero.
If you look at Jackson's own personal rise, it's a pretty impressive rise. It leaves a lot of dead people and a lot of displaced or abused populations behind it, including Indians, including slaves, including personally the people he shot. So, again, it's a complicated image. It shows this American character in both, you might say, its best and its most disturbing light at the same time.
In 1836, the American public voted for their next president. Andrew Jackson had served for 8 years. He did not want another term. He supported his vice president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had been very close to the outgoing president. In the election of 1828, Van Buren had been successful in forming a strong political alliance. This alliance helped put Jackson in the White House. Jackson was grateful for Van Buren's help and asked him to come to Washington to serve as Secretary of State. Van Buren quickly became the most powerful man in Jackson's cabinet. He was able to help Jackson in negotiations with Britain and France. But his greatest help was in building a strong political party for Jackson. Van Buren built up the Democratic Party by removing people from government jobs if they had not supported Jackson. These jobs were then given to those who had supported the president. Ultimately, it was the Democratic Party that gave Jackson wide support for his policies. Van Buren served as Jackson's Secretary of State for 2 years. By this time, Jackson had decided that Van Buren would be the best man to follow him as president. Jackson offered to resign after the 1832 elections and give Van Buren the job of president. Van Buren rejected the offer. He said he wanted to be elected by the people, but he agreed to be Jackson's vice president in 1832. 4 years later, at Jackson's request, the Democrats chose Van Buren to be their presidential candidate. Several candidates from the newly formed Whig Party opposed him, but the Whigs were divided, and Van Buren easily won the election. March 4, 1837 was a bright, cold day. The winter sun shone over the crowd that had gathered in Washington to watch the swearing-in of the new president. Andrew Jackson left the White House in the presidential carriage, riding beside Martin Van Buren. It was the first time a president and a president-elect rode to the Capitol together for the inauguration. The big crowd on the east side of the Capitol grew quiet when Jackson and Van Buren walked up the steps of the building. After Chief Justice Roger Taney swore in President Van Buren, the new president gave his inaugural speech. Then Andrew Jackson started slowly down the steps. A mighty cheer burst from the crowd. "For once," wrote Senator Thomas Hart Benton, an ally of Jackson, "the rising sun was eclipsed by the setting sun." The day after Van Buren became president, Jackson met with a few of his friends. Frank Blair, the editor of Jackson's newspaper, was one of them. Senator Benton was another. It was a warm, friendly meeting. They thought back over Jackson's years in the White House and talked about what had been done. Jackson said he thought his best piece of work was getting rid of the Bank of the United States. He said he had saved the people from a monopoly of a few rich men. Someone asked about Texas. Jackson said he was not worried about Texas. That problem would solve itself, he said. Did he have any regrets about anything? "Only two," said Jackson. "I regret I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun." The next morning, March 6th, Jackson left Washington to return to his home in Tennessee. Jackson was to leave the Capitol by train. Thousands of people lined the streets to the train station, waiting for a last look at their president. Jackson stood in the open air on the rear platform of the train. His hat was off, and the wind blew through his long white hair. The locomotive bell rang, there was a hiss of steam, and the train began to move. Jackson bowed. One man who was there said it was as if a bright star had gone out of the sky. Jackson lived for 8 more years. He read as many as 20 different newspapers, exchanged letters with many people in government, and spent time with his son and grandchildren. But Jackson's health had never been very good. He had been shot many years before, and the gunshot wounds created problems. Andrew Jackson died at home on June 8, 1845. He was 78 years old. Back in Washington, Martin Van Buren continued Jackson's legacy by carrying out many of his policies. Van Buren and his government will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.